Beyonce, Anine, Uju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Remember when a new Indigenous film would come out? It was always a big to-do. The community would gather, popcorn in hand, excited to celebrate all our relatives on the silver screen. Well, if it seems to be happening a lot more lately, you're right. TIFF programmer Jason Ryle says this rise in Indigenous screen culture means more room for diverse voices.
So as an Anishinaabe person, I really want to help foster, you know, Anishinaabe screen culture. And so, like, I think generationally looking forward, we're going to see a lot more of that.
Blackfoot filmmaker Sinox and Trevor Solway sees Indigenous people using film as a way to show authentic representations of themselves.
You're starting to see these authentic portrayals of what it means to be an Indigenous person globally. I think it's a really exciting time to be a filmmaker.
And Eva Thomas started out in L.A. as an actress, but the leather and feather roles pushed her back home to tell real stories about Indigenous people who face real issues.
I thought to myself at the time, you know, this is not going to change unless someone starts to create different kinds of projects and starts to write different kinds of stories. So I was like, okay, I better learn how to do that.
Today, Indigenous filmmakers who reverse the lens to create true representation on the big screen. Sinoxan Trevor Solway uses his camera to find clarity. In his latest documentary, he focuses his lens on masculinity. The Blackfoot filmmaker from Siksika Nation grew up on a ranch, riding horses, surrounded by expectations. He heard things like, man up, cowboy up, don't cry. His documentary, Siksikagawan, The Blackfoot Man, was shot in his community and is an intimate portrayal of what it means to be an Indigenous man. Sinoxan, welcome to Unreserved.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what are your, you know, what are some of your earliest memories around what it means to, quote, be a man?
Yeah, I grew up in Siksika Nation. It's the second largest reserve in Canada. You know, it's on the prairies and it's very rural, and like you can really feel like the land and its impact it's had on our people. And I think, you know, the Blackfoot people, history has us marked as the lords of the plains. And just growing up in Siksika, you hear all these like tales or like an oral history of who our people were, these very fierce warriors that protected their boundaries. And and then you see a lot of pride too in our people, and there's a lot of cowboy culture, and so everyone's either like a cowboy or like a hockey player. Those are kind of the only kind of ways to express yourself as a man in Siksika when I was growing up in the 90s. And also at the same time, like the representation we had in film and television was very limited to, you know, we had one film, Smoke Signals. And then we had these other kind of depictions of who we are in like Western movies and sports logos and Halloween costumes. And that kind of gave us a very narrow look at who we are. You know, either this like tough mask or this warrior kind of like archetype, or on the other hand, we're like this noble Indian that, you know, has beads and feathers and sits on a hilltop in regalia.
Mm-hmm. Early in your film, there is a text prompt on the screen that reads, growing up in Siksika, masculinity was all around me, but was unclear. What was unclear to you about masculinity and how it was being presented to you growing up?
Like, I was raised by my grandpa. He was an Indian cowboy. His name was Kadekidopi, the horse he never rode. His English name was Sonny Solway. He was such like a big presence in my life. And, you know, like a lot of my childhood was defined by work and chores and being out on the land. And I think that, you know, him being a survivor of residential school and just that generation of our grandparents that were survivors of that experience, you know, early on they were robbed of their childhood. They're not allowed to express their emotions in a healthy way or to even speak their language. And so I think growing up in that environment, like I didn't see a lot of I guess emotions, and I feel like my emotional intelligence was kind of stunted because of that. And so it's only now that, you know, I'm in my 30s and I'm a filmmaker and an artist that I'm now kind of starting to like understand myself better through filmmaking and through every project that I do, especially this one.
How is filmmaking, particularly with this documentary, helping you to answer or clarify those unclear questions that you had?
It's really beautiful to like witness somebody else's humanity. These aren't just my subjects, these are my community members. Like, these are people I grew up with, people who were part of making me the person I am today and the storyteller I am today. And so, you know, when filming with people, like it really taught me to be compassionate and to be patient and understanding. The mission of the film was to show us as human beings having a human experience and that we're not these one-dimensional beings that the world has known us as these, yeah, like I said earlier, like the savage archetype or like this noble Indian archetype. Like, we're much more than that. And I think that's really important for our own men to understand that, and our young people to understand that you do have unlimited potential and possibilities, that there's not just, your life doesn't have to result in, you know, a mugshot on the evening news.
You had said in your film that you wanted to, you know, find clarity about masculinity through your lens, which I just thought was really a powerful statement. What did you find as you try to show people that they could be more than their mugshot, as you say?
The clarity I found was that there's more than one way to be a man. It's a spectrum of experiences and emotions. Like, you're allowed to be sad, you're allowed to be angry, you're allowed to have joy, you're allowed to have tenderness, you're allowed to have grace. And I'm very thankful that everyone in my film had that courage to be vulnerable and to be themselves and to speak what was on their minds and hearts. And it was really beautiful to see somebody come to a conclusion of their existence of as a father, as a son, as a Blackfoot man.
One of the things I loved about this documentary was how you were intimate with your subjects and your community, and yet so gentle. And you gave them space to have that experience. There's a scene in your film, a young boy on a steer, and he looks kind of terrified. He's on the verge of tears, and people are shouting at him and telling him to stand, sit up straight. Can you describe what's happening there for our audience?
Yeah, so that's a scene, it's one of my favorite scenes in the film. It has this young boy, Lachey Big Tobacco, who's a preteen, I would say, and he's about to get on a steer, which is like a young bull, and it's at a community rodeo. And you know, he has all his friends and his cousins that are encouraging him to ride. He's not quite sitting on his steer yet. Like, he's kind of holding back, and you can't come out of the chute till you nod your head. And so everyone's telling him to nod his head, nod his head. And he's just filled with so much nervous energy and uncertainty. And eventually he does nod his head. And he did a really great job. He lasted the 8 seconds. And I seen him afterwards come out of the arena, and he was just brimming with confidence. But to get there was a lot of tension, a lot of pressure that he had to deal with. And you know, that's what kind of manhood is in a nutshell. You have, like, imagine that's what is in someone's head over and over again, like every day. I think when you're able to like witness someone's humanity like that, you're able to have more empathy for them. I think you hear his older cousin tell him like that's what it's about, to be nervous, validating his emotions and telling him like you just gotta be present and get on the steer and go.
We've talked a little bit about this, and you spoke a little bit about how this is your community, this is the people that you grew up with, and that gave you a certain access. But you also talked a little bit about Blackfoot teachings and how that informs your approach to this film. How does it inform you?
Yeah, I often think back about my grandpa. He used to always say this word, Nuapu Maka, you know, walk around and think about what I told you. He would tell a lot of stories about the land and about his upbringing, and there was always a lesson in there. Now that he's passed on, like, I really have developed a relationship with my uncle. His name is Ike Solway. And one of the things he teaches me is to see your life less of like a hierarchy and more of like a circle. So like you have like yourself, and your personal, like what you can control. Then there's like your family, then there's your friends, and then there's your wider community. And so I think seeing your life in this kind of cyclical nature, this collective approach, it really grounds me. And that's why all my films take place in Siksika, the people I know and people I trust. You know, the film that I make is going to represent a whole community. So I'm always kind of thinking about, you know, using my intuition to think about, you know, how is this going to not just impact myself, but my community.
Yeah. There's a moment that you capture in your film that really shows your personal connection to the people that, you know, that are your subjects in your film, because they're more than subjects, they're your family. It's a really intimate moment with Drew Robinson.
I said I was doing really good for a week.
Tell us what's happening in that moment.
One week there.
Yeah, so that's one of the subjects I'll be following in the film, Drew Robinson. And Drew is somebody I went to high school with, and, you know, we rode the bus together and spent a lot of time together in those, like, formative years. And I remember, like, even back then, he was very vulnerable and always spoke his mind. And so what Drew's doing in this scene is he's, you know, he works out in his dad's basement, and he's like, loves Muay Thai, so he loves his fitness. He's also, you know, a single father, so his daughter is like in a jumper playing with her toys. And every time I was filming it, Drew, and catching up with him, like, you could just get the sense he's putting a lot of pressure on himself.
Shit, if I had stayed with my routine, even with the kids here, and I had somehow pulled through, I'd probably be chiseled as hell right now, but I at least put on an extra 5 pounds worth of fat from just eating junk food and sugar and stuff.
And I don't think no one's ever asked him, like, directly, like, do you think you're too hard on yourself? And that's how we approached the interviews in this film. They're less of interviews, more of, like, candid conversations and mm-hmm. things that just came up in the moment. And so I asked him that question, and that's also the beauty of this film, is we just hold on moments. So I just, like, let that moment breathe and didn't ask any kind of follow-up, and you can see him arrive at his own thoughts.
You think you're too hard on yourself?
Yeah. Because if I'm not hard on myself, who will be? And it's finding that balance, that fine line. Yeah, you know, if someone's too hard on themselves, they can bring themselves down. Same thing if they're not hard on themselves enough. They're just too complacent and relaxed. But you find that right amount, that Goldilocks amount of self-criticism, it's motivational. You know, like, okay, you know. But, you know, yeah, I'm hard on myself.
If you were making this documentary, you know, in the more conventional way, subject filmmaker questions, do you think that you would have been able to capture that realization that he had?
No, I don't think so. And I think that even the act of, like, sitting somebody down and then doing your 3-point lighting and then you have the boom over top of them and then you mic them up, like, that whole I've done that. I made those films before. And when you do all that, like, if somebody's not used to being on camera, which most of our people aren't, they start to get in their own head about it. They start to, like, perform. And that's not something we wanted. So this film is very observational and like, hands-off. And it's less of, like, trying to make them conform to the camera and more trying to get the camera to conform to their life. And in that moment, too, with Drew and his daughter, like, you hear his daughter in the background, right? I could have been like, hey, she's being really noisy. Can your dad take her outside and play with her for a bit while we do this interview? But that is not real life. Like, Drew has to work out with his daughter in the basement. That's just the way his life is. And so it's about capturing real life.
I love that, you know, capturing life as it is instead of constructing the life that you think they're having. That's a very profound thought. There's a quote that you include in your film from Chief Crowfoot. I have two hearts. Treat me badly and my heart is like a stone. Treat me kindly and my heart is that of a child. How does that connect to masculinity in Siksika for you?
Yeah, you know, Chief Crowfoot is one of our most, you know, notable chiefs in history. He was a signatory of Treaty 7. And there's a lot said about him to this day. Like, he has a lot of stories of him counting coups and of being a fierce warrior. But there's also a lot of stories of him being kind and compassionate and thinking of the community. And so in another quote that we have in the film is, we are the children of the plains. And that's also from Chief Crowfoot. And, you know, that also like kind of counteracts the moniker Lords of the Plains, because in Blackfoot, the word Gedoks, you know, like the land that which sustains us, like the, you know, the prairies are our mother and we're their children, like it looks after us. And it, I find that so beautiful that we can be the lords of the plains and the children of the plains at the same time, and that there's room and space for all of these emotions and all of these experiences, and that we don't always have to like just pick the one or two options that are available to us to experience our, and express our manhood. And so that quote, in a nutshell, that's what I was trying to convey, is that there's room for both of those.
Yeah. You asked him also some important questions in the documentary. How do you film real people, and who tells our story? Why was it important for you to include those questions?
Yeah, I think, you know, like I've spoken about this, but the, you know, Native people have been at the forefront of cinema, you know, since the dawn of cinema. Mm-hmm. You had Thomas Edison recording a Pueblo ceremony on one of his dime machine cameras, and then you have Western films that were popular in the 1900s, and you know, I think they're a reason why they're popular in that time, because it was trying to send the message of manifest destiny and that this land is here for the taking, and there's all of these rhetorics that were embedded into the Western genre. Those films, they weren't made by us, but the camera was obsessed with us. You know, mm-hmm. we were, it's such a weird dynamic to be romanticized and villainized at the same time. And what does that do for our own people and their own self-image and their own confidence and ideas of themselves? And so I think we're at a, you know, a revolution of narrative sovereignty. We're seeing more and more Indigenous-led films with real Indigenous creatives at the helm of them. We're no longer just the token producer, like we're actual filmmakers and directors and camera operators and screenwriters who know what we're doing. So you're starting to see these authentic portrayals of what it means to be an Indigenous person globally, not just from Canada to the US, but to, you know, the Sami in Norway, to the Maori in New Zealand. I think it's a really exciting time to be a filmmaker and to tell stories. So I'm just thankful to do my part as a Blackfoot filmmaker and add to that canon of Indigenous cinema.
Now, after being on this journey with this beautiful film, what is something that, you know, if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self, what would you say to that young boy about what it is to be an Indigenous man?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, you don't have to work so hard to be liked and loved. Like you're good enough the way you are. And that if an emotion at any given time, if it's anger or sadness or joy, like you're allowed to have that emotion, and there's room for it to exist in your body. But it's what you do with that emotion, your reaction to it, and how you treat others that really matters. Always be authentic to you and how you're feeling. And to, in Blackfoot, Kitsugaku Mima, to love, you know, to love yourself and to love others.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for your time today, Sinaksin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sinaksin Trevor Solway is a Blackfoot filmmaker from Siksika Nation. His latest film is Siksikegawan, The Blackfoot Man. It was released this year and has been playing at festivals like Imaginative, Hot Docs, the Calgary International Film Festival, and the Edmonton International Film Festival. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Speaking of film festivals, every year the Toronto International Film Festival presents some of the best in international and Canadian film. Anishinaabe programmer Jason Ryle says this year there are more Indigenous films than ever.
It's exciting. I mean, what's amazing is that we have choice. We have a diversity of content, we have diversity of formats, and this is not true just in Canada, but around the world.
We'll hear more from Jason Ryle in a few minutes. Taking us there, A song that's on the soundtrack of one of those Indigenous feature films that premiered at TIFF this year. We'll tell you what that film is coming up. But here is DJ Shub featuring Tia Wood with Victorious. DJ Shub featuring Tia Wood with Victorious. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, the rise of Indigenous cinema. It's a cultural shift Jason Ryle has been watching. Jason is a programmer for the Toronto International Film Festival. This year, TIFF showcased a record number of Indigenous content, including 2 shorts and 8 feature films. Jason also acted as the executive director of the Imaginative Film and Media Arts Festival before moving to TIFF. He says this surge in Indigenous content is only the beginning. Jason, welcome to Unreserved.
Thanks very much, Rosanna.
Let's contextualize this moment for folks we're in right now when it comes to Indigenous cinema.
Absolutely. Well, you hit the nail on the head. Like, what's incredible and what we've been seeing for several years now is really just wave after wave of new talent. I mean, one of the most exciting things is when you hear of a filmmaker you haven't met before, you haven't seen their work before, and just, you know, sometimes they even have a body of work that you haven't encountered. You know, tie that in with this incredible cohort that really hasn't quite existed in the same way. You know, the likes of Dennis Goulet, Zoe Hopkins, Tasha Hubbard, people who started out 20 plus years ago, who really now are kind of an establishment that sort of, you know, hasn't existed in the industry. And this is, of course, you know, really building on the likes of Alanisa Bomsawin and the late Gil Cardinal and Loretta Todd. I mean, people who really laid the foundation stones for us. So you're right. It's exciting. I mean, what's amazing is that we have choice. We have a diversity of content. We have a diversity of formats. And this is not true just in Canada, but around the world.
Mm. And it seemed like at one point, most of the Indigenous films being made were documentaries. How has that changed?
Documentaries have really been a cornerstone for, you know, different Indigenous screen cultures. And I think every Indigenous nation, at least that I'm aware of, they began their journey into screen storytelling through very often short social justice documentaries. And I'm sure you can, you know, imagine why. I mean, it was about correcting truths, putting forward perspectives that were silenced, oppressed, or overlooked. And it's not that, you know, I think our storytellers didn't have remarkable stories and funny stories and romantic stories to share. There was an urgency to get those stories out. And sort of as we've come along and grown and diversified and fought for more space and claimed more space, we're really seeing that proliferation of different genre. I mean, things that as a programmer, I've been wanting to see for so long. Really, we're sort of like having this incredible bounty right now.
Mm. And when we use the term Indigenous cinema, what are we saying? What does that term mean?
I would love if we sort of talked about Indigenous cinema in the way that we talk about European cinema. We know innately that means German cinema, French cinema, British cinema. And in the same way for us, Indigenous cinema means Anishinaabe cinema. It means Maori cinema. It means Inuit cinema. And it's really exciting because we're at a point now, you know, with 20 years, I would say, of an immense growth in this industry, we can really talk at length and breadth of a diversity of an Indigenous nation's screen storytelling.
Yeah. And as we continue to see, you know, these waves of Indigenous cinema and the rise of cinema, are we going to ever get to a point where it's just cinema? Or will we always have this different sort of perspective lens?
I think, I mean, that's an interesting question in terms of the context of sort of where we're placing it. I think within our own nations, right, we know our artists, we know our storytellers, and of course we can recognize ourselves on screen. So there's certainly that shorthand. Mm-hmm. So I really love this notion of, you know, really focusing and looking ahead and really focusing on separate Indigenous national cinemas. So as an Anishinaabe person, I really want to help foster, you know, Anishinaabe screen culture. And so, like, I think generationally looking forward, we're going to see a lot more of that. I think we're going to see a lot more sort of definition or shape around different national cinemas that we have.
Mm. Growing up, what do you remember, you know, might be dating yourself or dating us, rather, but what do you remember, you know, about Indigenous representation on the screen?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was seeing Alanisa Bomsawin on Sesame Street. You know, I think this was the time when, you know, we were dealing with stereotypes predominantly in Westerns, negative stereotypes on the news. And looking back, I remember just being completely, you know, enraptured by seeing Alanisa on screen with Big Bird, with, you know, people that you know, these stars of your time. And realizing, I think, you know, looking back on it as an adult, realizing, okay, that was really one of the first, possibly the first real authentic
representation on screen of an Indigenous person. And I'm so happy it was Alanis. I mean, she's meant so much to this industry in Canada. She's meant so much, as you know, to nations across Canada and around the world.
She is a treasure. Protect Alanis at all costs.
Absolutely. And she's still making films. With, yes. And like, it's iconic, right? I mean, like, we're still getting new content from her.
Yeah, I remember when I interviewed her a few years ago, and she was very clear that she was like, I'm not done. Why is everybody talking to me like I'm finished?
It's so true. And it's wonderful talking about her because, I mean, one of the great gifts of the jobs that I've had is sort of being able to get to know her. And she's still fighting and she's still carving new paths. But she's always saying, take time to take stock, to acknowledge that things have changed for the better in some respects. Because she always reminds me, she was like, you know, there were times when an Indigenous lawyer, an Indigenous judge, an Indigenous doctor, Indigenous programmers just didn't exist. So, you know, it's always just a good reminder to celebrate what we've collectively achieved.
As a programmer now for the Toronto International Film Festival, I remember, you know, not having any Indigenous films playing there. How different do you think TIFF is now when it comes to, you know, playing these Indigenous films than, say, 20 years ago?
Absolutely. I mean, I think TIFF has had a long track record, especially through Jesse Wente and Dennis Goulet, who were also programmers at TIFF prior to me, in giving space to Indigenous films. I think importantly what's changed is a recognition and embracing of, again, what we've collectively worked to acknowledge within the industry, and that's Indigenous narrative sovereignty, understanding why it's important to support stories made by Indigenous filmmakers. And so really, I think that's been one of the things that TIFF has also embraced as part of their larger commitment to supporting our community, to supporting our industry. And, you know, I'm one of two current programmers who are First Nations at TIFF, Kelly Boutsalis, who's Mohawk from Six Nations. She's the Canadian Features Programmer. Collectively here, we've had 2 years in a row now where we've had 15 works play, which, you know, is a record year on year running. And I'm not, you know, I don't always want to set a benchmark. There's always different years. Sometimes years have more films than other years. It's just based on what's produced. But it really is remarkable, Rosanna, to be at TIFF with these incredible Indigenous filmmakers, actors, teams, producers, engaging at this large, world-class, significant film festival and having our own space there. And that's, it's something I dreamt about when, you know, you're really just getting into this industry and you're seeing it come to pass. And that is because of the hard work of so many people.
And is that why ultimately you wanted to, you know, enter this industry, was to make those changes and to, you know, oversee those changes?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how deliberate I am. I just sort of, you know, sometimes you just sort of follow. I was always attracted to film. I mean, my mom, Margie, I mean, she always took us to movies. Like, I remember going to E.T. and The Color Purple as children, and maybe The Color Purple we were probably a little bit too young for that, but it still had a positive impact because I think you get to understand film language and connect with, you know, with empathy and story. And so there was always an attraction to film for me, but maybe I didn't really understand what was available as careers within the larger scope of things. I love what I do. You know, one of the best educations I've had in my life is just watching all the Indigenous made films I've seen over the course of my now 20 plus career. And it's amazing to see how it's shifting and how it's continuing to grow. And it's just motivating year after year, Rosanna. It's just this beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. As you were growing up, watching these movies, E.T., The Color Purple, was there a moment for you when you were like, I want to see Indigenous people. I want to see an Indigenous E.T.?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You mean, you imagine yourself in those roles, right? And you imagine the people that you sort of see. And, you know, like, I would have a really active imagination as a kid, too. Like, there's stories that my sister probably would happily tell that would just embarrass me about, you know, trying to recruit all my cousins into some massive, you know, soap opera that I created in my head. And, you know, even if I didn't know the language of things like representation or authenticity or narrative sovereignty at that time, you know, you really do grasp onto those moments. And even Dances with Wolves, you know, was one thing. And one of the scenes that really stayed with me so much was, you know, the tenderness and love scene between Tenshu Cardinal and Gary Farmer on screen. And that one scene was just so pivotal for me because I had never seen us be loving or intimate on screen from a Hollywood point of view, right? And some years later, we got Smoke Signals by Chris Eyre, which again was just, you know, such a turning point.
That scene is also kind of hilarious, as Indigenous humor tends to be, because Dunbar's like staring at them awkwardly.
Yeah, someone's always watching.
Do you mind? I love that movie.
Yeah.
What changes do you still want to see for Indigenous cinema and, you know, Indigenous film making in the next 20 years?
It's not perfect, of course. I mean, we're making these, you know, we're very grateful that we have the Indigenous Screen Office in this country now. It's been a tremendous force of change. And the team there really has been instrumental in advocating for what producers and content creators want. You know, one of, I think, the next really sort of big levels of change that we really want to see is increasing access to our films. More are being made, but still really, I think, incumbent on a viewer to do the work to find these films. We can't just roll up to a cinema and find Indigenous films there necessarily. Oftentimes they're event-based, for sure. We've got wonderful things like ABTN Lumi, CBC Gem, you know, NFB.ca has a tremendous amount of Indigenous-made content in terms of documentary and shorts, including animation. So there's places that you can go to where you have, you know, you can find these works. But there's still so many incredible films, Rosanna, that I've seen through my work that just aren't accessible. But that's sort of really what I think we want to see. It's about discoverability. It's about access to these films.
Mm. Jason, thank you so much for your time today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks, Rosanna.
Jason Ryle is a producer and programmer. He is Anishinaabe and a member of Lake St. Martin First Nation. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, from docs to drama, Indigenous filmmakers making films in their own image. One of the feature movies that premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival this year is Nika and Madison. The crime thriller is directed and co-written by Eva Thomas. Her first feature film, Nika and Madison, is about two Indigenous women who are forced to go on the run after a violent encounter with a predatory policeman. It draws inspiration from her acclaimed 2023 short film, Red Lights. And while police violence is the spark here, Nika and Madison is really a story of friendship, survival, and resilience. Eva is a member of the Walpul Island First Nation. She is Tanawtum, Cherokee, and Scottish. Eva, welcome to Unreserved.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure. And so tell me a little bit about the film. Why did you want to make it and what's it about?
Yeah, I was really interested in the place where law enforcement meet Indigenous people. And you should think that the police are a safe place, but sometimes for Indigenous people, they really aren't. And it took great inspiration from the film Thelma Louise. I remember watching this film as a child thinking, oh, I just don't understand. Why don't they go to the cops? That's what I'm telling myself in my little kid brain. And then when I watched it as an adult, I could see why they couldn't go. I could see that it was complicated. There were more layers that I could see. And I thought to myself, if these two women, these two white women, couldn't go to the police, what if they were two Indigenous women and they really couldn't go to the police? And that was the spark of the idea.
Very powerful premise of that. I love that film, by the way. I've watched that a million times, but I'm not going off a cliff for anybody. Sorry.
Right?
Sorry, not sorry. I'm scared of heights. So I understand also that something that Indigenous people are very familiar with here, at least in Canada, on this side of the Medicine Line, is the Starlight Tours. Can you share about what the Starlight Tours are and how that fed into your film?
Yes, certainly was a major theme in Red Lights. Starlight Tours are something we know here in Canada as a practice by police of taking vulnerable Indigenous people, often drunk or maybe not in their full power, an agency, and putting them in the back of cop cars and then taking them out into the middle of nowhere and leaving them to often die or to make their way back in really sub-zero temperatures. So this was a practice that I became aware of as an Indigenous person in Canada, and was very shocking to me, but also was a way to tell that story of where Indigenous people meet law enforcement. So in Red Lights, that was certainly the spark and the inciting incident of that film.
Yeah. Perhaps the most well-known instance of a Starlight Tour is, you know, the tragic death of Neil Stonechild.
Yes.
And that was called a Starlight Tour. Nika and Madison portrays that fear that many Indigenous people have when confronted, as you say, by law enforcement. Is this an experience that you or someone you know has had?
Not me personally, but I do know people who have had not pleasant run-ins with the police. I also had the opportunity to be a consulting producer on a documentary called Dark Highway, and it was about human trafficking up and down the 401 in Ontario. And that freeway goes through probably about 10 Indigenous communities along it. And so many of the people we interviewed for that project were Indigenous. And the stories they told of their encounters with police was very disturbing.
Yeah.
And I felt like I wanted to explore that a bit more and sort of expanded the interaction with police in Nika and Madison to be more about sexual assault than it was in the short. And mm-hmm. so that's a bit of a theme of the feature version.
Yeah. And I want to get into that a little bit more. But what kinds of things were people telling you as you were doing that documentary?
That police were not safe places, and that police were sometimes some of their most frequent customers. And it just really disturbed me. And I guess I wanted to say something about it. And so I made a whole movie.
Yeah, you certainly did have something to say about it. Tell me a little bit more about the characters in the film, Nika and Madison, starring Ellen Jade and Star Slade, respectively. Who are they?
Sure. I got a little bit of a country mouse, city mouse, or res mouse, city mouse theme going on. Nika is a res girl. She lives on the res. She lives off the land. She hunts. She knows how to tan a hide. She doesn't like leaving the res. Very comfortable for her. Maybe too comfortable in that sort of, she set up her life so she could live in her version of safety. Whereas Madison is venturing off into the city, and she's a student at the University of Toronto. And so they've kind of, were quite close when they were growing up, and kind of have separated and gone separate ways and separate lives. So when Madison comes home for the weekend to visit, this is when the incident happens. And Madison is the one who invites Nika to come to the, you know, local bar. Let's go out. It'll be a good time. And Nika really doesn't want to. And so Madison goes off with her friends and finds herself in the back of a police car, and our movie begins.
Yeah. Nika's a bit of a badass, I gotta say.
Yes. Yes, she is. And Ellen Jade is just spectacular. Both Ellen Jade and Star are really fantastic in the film. And yeah, Nika's a bit of a badass, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, she scared me a little bit, but that's in a good way. As you said, Madison is the one that eventually has that encounter with the police officer. Let's hear a clip from the movie.
Is that everything? There's no details you're leaving out?
No.
Are you sure?
Positive.
That's exactly what happened. There's no bullshit that you're not telling
me? Chief! Easy there. I brought them here because they need help.
Look, I'm responsible here. I have to make sure that under pressure, they're not going to change their story and make us look like a bunch of fools for believing them.
He tried to rape me.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had to ask. Are you okay?
I'm okay, yeah.
Okay, so at minimum, there's an assault against an officer.
No matter what they tell us, if they take these girls.
Yes, yes, okay. So, I need you to go home. Don't talk to anyone. Don't let anyone see you. You understand?
And then?
I have to make some phone calls. And then I'll come over as soon as I can, okay? Oh, give me your phones.
Why?
Until we understand what we're up against, I want to be the one controlling the narrative.
That was a short clip from the movie Nika and Madison, co-written and directed by Eva Thomas. So I recognize some voices in there, some legendary Indigenous actors, Billy Morasty and Gail Maurice. Tell me what's happening in that scene.
Billy Morasty, who's fabulous.
So fabulous.
he plays the uncle, a very sturdy, calming uncle, protective figure. And when the girls come back home after the incident, they share with him what happens, and he wants to take them to the chief to get help. And the chief in our movie is played by the fabulously wonderful, talented Gail Maurice. And she's in full chief mode. She wants to help, but, you know, she's got to make sure that she's got all the facts.
Yeah. Yeah. Also a badass, by the way, Gail Maurice, in love life and Gail. On the screen.
Yes, I agree completely. Gail Maurice, one of my favorite people, and I love her so much.
Yeah. You know, this movie and the theme centers around, you know, police interactions with Indigenous people. How would you describe that relationship between police and Indigenous communities currently?
It's complicated.
That's a very kind way to put it.
I mean, I think you just can't get away from the fact that, you know, some of these police forces were created to control us. And sadly, people who find themselves in those positions maybe, perhaps, you know, have power and control issues. And, you know, maybe some of those people are also a little bit racist. So when you put all those things together, it just sort of is not always the safest space for us. And even I just, when the lights go off in my rearview mirror, I instantly get absolutely like terrified. And that comes from many experiences, not only as an Indigenous person. I mean, I think many Black communities, Latino communities, they also feel the same way, that it's just not always the safest space and place for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that most you know, non-Indigenous Canadians understand, you know, just how problematic that relationship can be?
Maybe. It's hard to not be aware that it's a problem. But I also think for many years, we as Indigenous community knew about the residential schools. We knew what was going on. And I think that came to a surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Even with the Starlight Tours in my short film, so many people, and it really surprised me, had no idea what a Starlight Tour was and never heard of it. And that part was surprising to me, which is why I probably say maybe they know.
Yeah. It's surprising to me, too. You know, often people come from the perspective, well, it's never happened to me, therefore it must not happen at all.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting perspective, I suppose.
But I'd like to think, as I'm still a little bit of an idealist, a little bit of a positive dreamer, that I think we are getting better as a society. I never thought in my lifetime I would see thousands of people wearing orange shirts in the streets. I just never thought that would happen. So that surprises me too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Canadians like to think that we're good people. And so I think it's a cognitive dissonance for them to be like, how can we be these good people and also this happening? But I think we, in the last 10 years or so, have made great strides to moving to a better place.
Absolutely. And yet it has been 10 years since, you know, the 9-to-4 calls to action from the TRC were presented. There are many calls for changes to the justice system, policing, all the way throughout, which has been called, you know, systematically racist by former Justice Maurice Sinclair. And many of those, you know, have not yet been addressed. What can films like yours help us understand, you know, about this need for change to policing and the justice system when it comes to how Indigenous people are treated?
Well, I think it certainly grows awareness. Even with my short film, there was certainly an educational component of the film that I didn't intend and didn't think would be something that would be part of the journey of that short film. But so many people became aware of it. And that short film went to 30 film festivals around the world. So I think that was surprising to some of these countries that hosted the film that, oh, this happens in Canada. I think the Indigenous Screen Office here in Canada, which has supported me and my projects and also my development as a creative, is really integral to us having really agency and funding and opportunities to tell our stories. I think we're just beginning having agency and telling our stories. But there's something that happens when you, what's that old, that saying? I really like it. It's, tell me the facts and I'll learn, but tell me a story and I'll remember it forever, or something like that. There's something in the storytelling that I think reaches people in a different way than if you saw like a news story. Something about being in the theater or choosing to watch a movie and sitting down and being open to it and opening your heart and mind. And at the end, you know, I understand now. If that's a reaction that my audiences get, is like, oh, I get it now. Understand. It's a very powerful tool that film does. Machines of Empathy that we can create empathy.
Absolutely. In the bigger picture, as is to use a horrible pun, you mentioned the Indigenous Screen Office and Indigenous people, the importance of Indigenous people telling their own stories. Is that something that has always driven you, this need to tell Indigenous stories, particularly as an Indigenous woman? You know, there's not a lot of us out there being allowed these spaces, or, you know, how are you looking at your role as an Indigenous woman in this field?
Oh, that's a really good question. Actually, I started as an actress. I just wanted to work in movies. I didn't really think of it at the time as sort of like, I want to work in Indigenous content. I just wanted to tell stories. But then as I tried to go out for roles and projects, it became really limiting in the type of roles that I could get, like a handful of years ago, of course, about 10 years ago. I was in LA trying to be an actress. And a lot of the things that I would go out would be these like leather and feather gigs. They wanted to put us on a horse, put me in leather and put feathers in my hair. And I worked every October for the Thanksgiving commercials and the Thanksgiving episodes of soap operas. It became really limiting. And I thought to myself at the time, well, you know, this is not going to change unless someone starts to create different kinds of projects and starts to write different kinds of stories. So I was like, okay, I better learn how to do that. At the same time, I could see that there was something really interesting happening in Canada, that there was this emergence of an Indigenous film and television community. And I thought to myself, I should go home and be a part of that. And I'm really glad that I did, because it really did change the trajectory of my career. Through that process, I came to sort of understand the responsibility as an Indigenous creative, that I'm telling stories hopefully that audience enjoy and they come out and they want to see it, but also that I'm showing my community on film. And for many, many years, we didn't have that. So it's a very empowering position to be in. And this year at TIFF, there's 8 Indigenous feature films, and that's the most that we've ever had at TIFF. And
that's
really
amazing.
I'm really happy to be a part of it.
That is wonderful to hear that more and more of us are telling our stories. And as we continue to do so, are you hopeful that we will be able to make our own spaces ultimately and have our own theaters and movies? Like, where do you think this wave of storytelling is heading?
Well, I think we're very early in the days of us having agency on our projects. I'm really excited about the type of projects that we're seeing. We have drama, we have comedies, we have horror, traditional tales told on film. It's really nice to see not only the breadth of stories that we have to tell, but the different genres and formats that we're telling them in. It's great. I think we'll only get more of it. And I think there is an interest in the general mainstream Canadian society in a way that maybe wasn't there 10 or 15 years ago, that there's a real interest in Indigenous content.
Thank you so much for your time today, Eva.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Eva Thomas is a filmmaker and screenwriter. She is a member of the Walpole Island First Nation. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Zoe Tennant, Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hutchins-Lyle, and Amanda Gear. You can now listen to Unreserved, streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Kina naskimit nawa. I just say.